Member Week is back at Lowe's with big savings for pros. Now through October 15th, my Lowe's Pro Rewards members get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, tools, building materials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings before they're gone. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
With dignity, don't lay down with tears and agony. There's nothing to death. It's like Max said, it's just stepping over in another plane. Don't be this way. Stop this hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists and communists to die. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Today's episode and the next few episodes were something I've always wanted to cover but didn't feel fully prepared to tackle it because it's just so heartbreakingly huge. How did this happen? Well, we're going to find out over the next three episodes. We've covered a ton of coal leaders over the years on this podcast, but none as prolific as the subject of today's case, Jim Jones. A drug-fueled egomaniac with a silver tongue who destroyed so many lives. And not only destroyed, forced them to commit mass suicide. And in his case, I consider it murder. So after we drove east for North Carolina over the holidays, we decided to head north and visit Greg's family in Indianapolis, which is where I got inspiration for this episode. You see, I had no idea that the birthplace of perhaps the most infamous cult leader and cults was born out of the crossroads of America, Indiana. The first People's Temple was in none other than downtown Indy, off New Jersey Street. That might not mean a lot to you all if you haven't been there, but Indiana roots run deep in Greg and his family. In fact, it's frankly embarrassing how obsessed he is with it, and every single one of his friends from Indiana. And by the way, the majority of his friends are from Indiana. Even if they all moved out to LA, it's like Indiana people stick together. They're so into Indiana.
Who's yours?
I'm you should see yourself out. Joking. Sources for this episode are a New York Times article from 1978 written by Robert Lindsay called Jim Jones, From Poverty to Power of Life and Death, an Indy Star article by Will Higgins, Jim Jones, His Indianapolis Life, Included Performing Miracles and Selling Monkeys. This is going to get very weird and also extremely tragic. A Crime Reads blog post, Wikipedia, and the documentaries Jonestown Terror in the Jungle by AMC, directed by Shan Nicholson, and Deborah Layton's book Seductive Poison.
I wanted to mention also that I would have been scalded to death if it was not for Father, and I appreciate it and thank him very much.
I really appreciate being here, being able to work under Father's direction, and I'm waiting for the whole family to be here as soon as possible.
Hello, family. It's such a joy and great pleasure being here because of Father's love.
I'd like to say that Father truly saved my life a few days ago, and I'm sure that some of you have heard it over the radio, but it was a miraculous miracle. I wouldn't be sitting here tonight. I should be dead, and I really thank Father because there's no one I could have called on but Father, and he came to me in that time, and I thank him very much.
And because of his love, by bringing down a nurse practitioner with him, we all were given hourly exams today and all found to be in perfect health.
So who was Jim Jones? He was born James Warren Jones in Crete, Indiana, a small, basically non-existent town where I can't seem to find a population number for, so I'm going to go with a smattering of folks. It was located next to the bustling metropolis of Lynn, Indiana, and as of the 2010 census, had about 1,000 residents. When Jim Jones was born on May 13th, 1931, I can only imagine that it was smaller or possibly more bustling. People moved out, knowing the only well-known figure to come out of the area was Jim Jones. That's just bad PR. What's crazy is, I was on the phone with my father-in-law a couple days ago, and I was teasing him saying the subject of my podcast this week was from Indiana, And because, like I said, he and Greg are, and basically everyone I've met from Indiana has the most insane state pride. So I say to my father-in-law, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, he's the electrician talking about dangerous near-miss situations in the electrical profession. So I say to him, I wouldn't be so proud of Indiana. Did you know Jim Jones was from there? And he goes, oh yeah, I did some electrical work on his first church. I was like, what? Sorry, that was awfully casual. How have you never told me that before? You know that I do this podcast for a living. And it was then that I realized that Mike Hunter is the Forrest Gump of Indiana. Anyway, so Jim Jones was born in an area. So this is Lynn. You can't really get any information on Crete, but I think it's like an unincorporated. Yeah, at least they had a post office in Lynn. So anyways, Jim Jones was born in an area where, as of 2022, the estimated median household income is $43,611. That's not bad. It was $32,368 in 2000. The estimated median house in 2022 there, $88,322. It was $63,000 in the year 2000. Versus Indianapolis, which is $208,700. The median gross rent there is $617, which I think that's pretty fair. I don't know if that's for a one bedroom or whatever. The percentage of residents living in poverty in 2022 was 16.9%, 17.8% for white non-Hispanic residents, and 1.9% for two or more race residents. And I stand corrected on the population either growing or people leaving the town once Jim hit the news, because at least according to IN.gov, I imagine that means Indiana.gov. Once it was founded in the mid-1800s, the town of Lynn is located 85 miles east of the state capital of Indianapolis and 6 miles west of the Ohio state line. The town has two U.S. highways that intersect 27 and 36. The town has a population of around 1,200, and that has not changed much since the beginning of 1847. So people love Lynn. They stay there. They're not apparently deterred by Jim Jones being the only public figure listed on Wikipedia as like a notable figure. So Jim Jones was born in the microscopic town of Crete and later lived in Lynn. He was initially described as shy or perhaps withdrawn, not as into the same things as other kids. He was very religious. But perhaps he knew that at a young age, religion would be where he would find his fame. But shockingly, like a lot of cult leaders we've covered, he didn't try to be a rock star. If you haven't listened to the Tony Alamo series, I mean, his music is absolutely awful. Charles Manson, which is not that bad. Father Yod, probably the best of all of them.
For sure.
What's the other one we kind of liked? Real folky music.
David Koresh?
Yes, I forgot about that. I don't remember if I liked the music, but yes, that was like a big theme in his thing. And this is kind of a Waco, but way more. You can't compare them. It's apples to oranges. They're both horrifying. So maybe Jim Jones, like, not thinking like, all right, I'm going to be a rock star. Maybe he was smarter and knew religion was his in to be famous. He didn't, you know, go down that other path. He was just like, nah, I'm just going to circumvent that. Because although he was described as shy by some, others said he had a deep-rooted need for attention. Attention and control. And it's going to become very clear by the end of this series that that couldn't be more true.
We have no face to lose because we've said we're no panacea. But I have seen more healings here than I've ever seen any place.
But I'm getting ahead of myself. It's not hard to know by the name Jim Jones what happens at the end. You know how they say that the truth is stranger than fiction? Well, the truth of this story is worse than any fictional horror movie a writer could conjure up. And I'm sure everyone listening knows the ending, but my aim is to dive deeper. Speak to survivors if I can. I have reached out to one of the main ones I'd like to speak to, so fingers crossed I hear back. You're in for a deep dive of likes the scariest, saddest, most prolific stories Seven Deadly Sinners has ever covered.
Did you once lose a loved one? I think the name of James.
Yes, that's my brother.
He was 14 years of age. And someone, he was reading something. And someone asked him for what he had. And he didn't want to give it.
Yes,
and that person shot him today.
Yes, he did.
I'm saying this to give you faith.
Yes.
So that you can mount up, because you've been feeling pain here in the chest.
Yes.
And in the back.
Yes.
And you injured your foot some time ago, and
yes,
you've been having
it
constant pain in it, or you had to move around with a chair.
Yes, it did.
I do not know you, and you've told me or no one else the things I just mentioned.
No,
is that
you sure have.
Now, where's your pain?
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
But before we dive deeper, trigger warning on every level for this subject. I don't recommend listening around people who are sensitive to this content, or if you're sensitive yourself, and absolutely, certainly not around children. But hey, you are the parent. I'm not trying to Jim Jones control you. Hell, I'm not even a parent. I'm joking, but seriously, please take care when listening. So this horror story is born in the rural areas of Indiana in the thick of the Great Depression. Sandwiched in between World War I and World War II, Jim's parents were coming off of World War I. His dad, James Thurman Jones, was a disabled World War I. Why is that so hard to say? World War I veteran. It's easier when you say it slower. World War I. Okay. He had been exposed to mustard gas in France. His mom, Lynetta, I think that's a very pretty name, she was ambitious, college educated, and wanted a bigger life than her life turned out to be. Perhaps her ambition and need to have to work to support the family gave her little time to spend with her young son. Jim's dad also had little interest in him. Likely depressed from the war, and maybe depressed from being stuck in this tiny town. But Jim sort of turned this into an advantage for him. Left to fend for himself, Jim trolled around Lynn trying to find anything to entertain himself. He'd hit the library and, not surprisingly, smack dab in the Bible Belt, there were many churches he could frequent. And perhaps he was drawn to church and religion because his mom said when he was born, she believed he was the Messiah. Okay, so many sources say that. But you know how when you Google stuff nowadays, it says AI overview, which I hate. AI bugs me. Maybe I'll eventually change my opinion, but anyways, I don't know how it can know everything. Was it a reporter that talked to people affected by the story? No, it's a robot, but I'll give the robot the floor for a second. So according to the Google AI overview, Lynetta Jones was a tough-talking, independent woman who didn't believe in a sky god. She was often working and her husband, James Thurman Jones, was emotionally absent, so they didn't have much time to discipline Jim. Jim's family didn't attend church, but neighbor Myrtle Kennedy became a grandmother figure to him and introduced him to religion. Jim's mother was disturbed when she saw him imitating the pastor of the local Pentecostal church. She tried to stop him from going to church services. So, completely two differing things there. There's like reporters in the articles that have said, and I don't know if I've gotten to that part in Deborah Layton's book, but real people say that she said he was the Messiah. AI says she was actually freaked out by it, so I don't know. Myrtle Kennedy, the wife of the Nazarene Church pastor, developed a special attachment to Jones. She gave Jones a Bible and encouraged him to study it, teaching him to follow the holiness code of the church. As Jones grew older, he attended services at most of the churches in Lynn, often going to multiple churches each week, and he was baptized in several of them. Jones developed a desire to become a preacher as a child, and he began to practice preaching in private. His mother claimed that she was disturbed when she caught him imitating the pastor of the Pentecostal church. Okay, that did come from Wikipedia, so I guess Wikipedia also said it, but that was probably created by AI. But she was unsuccessful in attempting to prevent him from attending the church's services. Who knows? Either Jim Jones was born thinking he was the Messiah, was born with the need for fame and attention and control, developed it later once he saw how the Pentecostal preachers around him could command a room, and he wanted to command like them, better than them. He would be the most powerful religious leader, even if he had to die for it. So he's soaking up the vibe in these churches. And Pentecostalism is the perfect breeding ground for theatrics. With the laying of hands and healing and speaking in tongues, throwing yourself on the ground, the preacher claiming God was speaking directly through them. The overwhelming nature of the room almost creates a mass hysteria in these churches. Not necessarily the same as shared psychosis or faux delay. I'm probably saying that wrong. It's French for madness of two, which is also called, like I said, shared psychosis, which is a rare psychiatric syndrome in which symptoms of a delusional belief are transmitted from one individual to another. That was a term coined by a 19th century Frenchman who was in the psychiatry field, a term and like a phenomenon. Kind of like that, but I feel like it reminds me more of the dancing plague of 1518 in nearby Germany. This is a real thing. So this outbreak began in July of 1518, when a woman began to dance uncontrollably in a street in Strasbourg, Germany. According to Ned Pennant Ray, this woman had started dancing on July 14th in the narrow cobbled street outside her half-timbered home. As far as we can tell, she had no musical accompaniment, but simply began to dance. Some of those who had witnessed her strange performance had begun to mimic her, and within days, more than 30 people were in the same trance, dancing nonstop. It's said that only death would be the thing to stop them. And death, it did. Just a month later in August, this crazy dancing epidemic had claimed 400 people. Whether it be from exhaustion, hunger, heart attack, or stroke, it was mass hysteria. The victims' movements were described as spasmodic, with many convulsions, and their bodies were drenched in sweat. Their arms would thrash violently, and some noted that their eyes were vacant and expressionless. There's no exact explanation for why such a bizarre phenomenon broke out. We can't talk to anyone from, 1518. There are many theories, which we won't get into, because this isn't a podcast about that. It's about Jonestown, but when people speak in tongues and throw themselves around after seeing others do it and get so enraptured by the moment, it kind of just reminded me of this. I remember when I would attend this, and I'm not saying this was like culty or as dramatic as a Pentecostal or Baptist church, but I attended this church when I was in junior high with my best friend at the time. Her family basically ran the church. When my dad was sick, my parents were traveling to the Mayo Clinic regularly, I would stay with them. So they were bringing me to this church constantly. So perhaps mixed with my emotions and worry for my dad, plus the fact that this family basically controlled the whole thing and I was staying with them for periods of a time, I was taken to the church. And I distinctly remember the feeling of being like, wow, I'm being touched by the Holy Spirit. And I remember going forward to be saved, crying and being wrapped up in the music. But then again, I've also done that at a Fleetwood Mac concert. But there's just something about the power of the masses. You pick up on the energy, and someone like Jim Jones, who craved attention, saw this as his in. Soon, while attending the churches, parishioners would encourage the dark-eyed, dark-haired boy with a silver tongue and relatively good looks to go up to the pulpit and read scripture. Little did they know, and how could they, that they were creating a monster. His obsession with religion left him kind of isolated. His peers thought he was weird for being so obsessed with it. They wanted to play sports, they wanted to be outside, but he was so obsessed with it, and also with socialist and communist ideals. He would devour books on Stalin, Karl Marx. He was often seen reading the Bible, basically devouring much of the ideology that he would use to lure his followers into his web and manipulate hundreds of followers with. He would also read books on Hitler and Gandhi. A motley crew of idols to study. But his isolation and peers and others being wary of him wasn't just because of his obsession with religion. It was also perhaps even more due to his obsession with death. Allegedly, although the community, peers, anyone that really came across him, because of his charisma, but they also felt for him because of the neglect he claimed to have received by his parents and his growing up poor, they felt for him. But his neighbors also reported that he was different as a child. And if this story is true, which one can only suspect after what happens at the end of this story, I would say creepy. A red flag, if you will. His neighbors allegedly reported that, yes, he was obsessed with religion, but also obsessed with death, and Jones regularly visited a casket manufacturer in Lynn and held mock funerals for roadkill that he collected. Now, the roadkill part could be considered sweet. I mean, he didn't want the roadkill to not be properly buried, but hanging out at the local casket manufacturer, like kids in other small towns like mine hang out at the local mini-mart, is next level goth and a very eerie predictor to what would happen later. So, like I said, his strange religious practices stood out the most to his neighbors, but they also reported that he misbehaved more seriously. He frequently stole candy from merchants in town, and his mother was required to pay for his thefts. Joan regularly used offensive profanity, commonly greeting his friends and neighbors by saying, "Good morning, you son of a bitch," or "Hello, you dirty bastard." I think it's kind of funny. But similar to his mother kind of did something similar, who frequently swore in public and found amusement in people being offended at a woman cursing. Jones's mother usually beat him with a leather belt, they said, too, to punish his misbehavior. Well, he's getting it from somewhere. Commenting on his childhood, this is from Jim Jones himself. He said, "I was ready to kill by the end of third grade. I mean, I was so aggressive and hostile, I was ready to kill. Nobody gave me love, any understanding. In those days, a parent was supposed to go with a child to school functions. There was some kind of school performance and everybody's parent was there but mine. I'm standing there alone. I was always alone."
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
But he also had a progressive view for the time. I think a human view, but if he was being the rare stand-up white person at the time, unapologetically friends with anyone no matter their race or social status, then I commend him. But if this played into his manipulations, it's hard to know. Both can be true. He was complicated. So later, Jim would claim that his dad was a racist alcoholic who had affiliations with the KKK. And Jim did not like his dad. He didn't respect him. He thought he was better than him. But if his dad was a racist alcoholic, I have to say that that would pale in comparison to what Jim did become. Still, not great. Not great at all. But does the senior, James, Jim Jones, have mass suicide on his resume? No. But Jim Jones, Jr., was always still very kind toward people who were struggling during the time. Was this a recruitment tactic? Or was he just unbiased and didn't see race? He also eventually adopted several kids of various races. He wanted this blended family. It is possible that he was a good person in that way. It's possible that he saw the injustice that these minorities face and they tugged at his heartstrings or made him want to say, "Fuck you, Dad." Either way, that is an aspect of who he was. Complicated, and we'll never know the motives. We can only speculate. According to a few sources, at one point, his allegedly racist dad wouldn't let one of his new friends into the house when Jim brought him over to hang as a kid. And this led Jim not to speak to his dad for years, because that friend was black. In 1945, Jim's parents divorced. Not surprising, but another psychological mark on Jim's timeline of life. He chooses to go live with his mom, and they move to a much bigger area, Richmond, Indiana, a town of 30,000. In 1949, when Jim was in his late teens, he meets a woman named Marceline, and she becomes his wife. They get married quickly, and like young people do in the Midwest, especially when you're in the Bible Belt and obsessed with religion and clearly appearances, you just get married quickly. Keeping up with the Joneses. No pun intended. I'll see myself out. That wasn't a good joke. She was a young nurse, 22 years old, to his just out of high school, 18 years old. And they met when he was still in high school. How, I don't know, but perhaps the 18-year-old had already developed his ability to talk people into things, or maybe she was just into him. Who knows? The 4-year age difference isn't that big of a deal, but they marry. He goes on to attend IU, Indiana University, in Bloomington, Indiana, where he and his new wife move together. Go Hoosiers! That's Greg's alma mater. I just said alma mater weird. And a hell of a football team recently, I will tell you this. They were always known for basketball, but America, we got a football team here now.
Wow, I'm proud of you.
A sport Jim likely never played. He was an all-star in the sport of playing people, though. He was at IU with the intention of becoming a doctor, but after 2 years, he and his wife moved to Indianapolis. Through the years, Joan's marriage was affected by his insecurity. He often felt the need to test Marceline's love and loyalty, and at times he used sadistic methods to do so. One reoccurring tactic he used was to tell her that one of her close friends or family members had suddenly died, and then comfort her over the loss, before finally admitting to her the story was untrue. After relocating to Indianapolis, Jones took night classes at Butler University to continue his education, finally earning a degree in secondary education in 1961. He gets a degree, finally. But something that heavily influenced him since 1951, when he was 20 years old, something he couldn't get off his mind, was that in 1951, the 20-year-old Jones began attending gatherings of the Communist Party in Indianapolis. Jones and his family faced harassment from government authorities for their affiliation with the Communist Party during 1952. Jones later asserted that in one event, his mother was harassed by FBI agents in front of her coworkers because she had attended a communist meeting with her son. Jones became frustrated with the persecution of communists in the U.S. This isn't surprising, considering the Red Scare of the time. And maybe we'll do a full series on that. It's fascinating, but it was a huge deal. Being labeled a commie, even being suspected of knowing someone who believed these ideals, and I'm not saying that they had to be violent ideals, just believing in communism was literally the worst thing in America of the time. You had to hide in secret. It even hit Hollywood. Major actors were accused, studios. I could go on about it, but it was a huge deal. I think we will cover it, maybe even next after Jim Jones, because it is really fascinating when you dive into it, and Jim Jones was a communist, so go seamlessly into it. Reflecting back on his participation in the Communist Party, Jones said that he asked himself, how can I demonstrate my Marxism? The thought was, infiltrate the church. And so, he did. He began his religious career in 1952. Not heading a church at first, but dipping his toes in. His wife had been raised Methodist, and so he attempted that for a while. In the summer of 1952, Jones was hired as a student pastor to the children at the Somerset Southside Methodist Church, where he launched a project to create a playground that would be open to children of all races. Jones continued to visit and speak at Pentecostal churches while serving as a Methodist student pastor, though. He felt called to the pomp and circumstance of the Pentecostal movement. Jones was eventually able to successfully convince his wife to leave the Methodist Church and join the Pentecostals. In 1953, Jones began attending and preaching at the Laurel Street Tabernacle in Indianapolis. Jones held healing revivals there until 1955, and began to travel and speak at other churches in the Latter Rain movement. He was a guest speaker at a 1953 convention in Detroit. The Assemblies of God was strongly opposed to the Latter Rain movement. In 1955, they assigned a new pastor to the Laurel Street Tabernacle, who enforced their denominational ban on healing revivals. This led Jones to leave and establish Wings of Healing, a new church that would later be renamed People's Temple. His new church attracted only 20 members at first, who had come with him from the Laurel Street Tabernacle, and he was not able to financially support his vision. At one point, he even sold pet monkeys to raise funds for his church. Where he got the monkeys to sell, I don't know. Don't you have to purchase them before? I don't know. But Jones saw a need for publicity, and he began seeking a way to popularize his ministry and recruit members. Maybe the monkeys were a publicity stunt. So he eventually was able to begin growing his following due to his charisma. He was an evangelist that often spoke so fast and ramble. Who else does that? Me? That people didn't even know what he was saying, but he was charismatic enough that they could find a kernel in there that tugged at their heartstrings. There was something that was maybe going on in their life, and while he's doing that, he's like, well, praise Jesus, and I can heal you, and cough up that cancer. You know, whatever. They can find a kernel of truth in there that works for them. Speak fast, but if they hear a word, what?
You might have another career.
Well, I don't know. Maybe an auctioneering. I know for me, when people speak super loud and fast, I get so confused and overwhelmed that I either shut down or I'll just go along with anything just to shut them up. Not really, but I get that, like, I get real nervous when that happens, and I can see how these people would kind of just be like confused and like subdued by it. It's just like, you know, praise Jesus, if you're going to go to hell, if you don't do that. Like, you're just sort of like, okay, stop yelling at me, sir. Anyways, so he also started doing faith healings, either being so charismatic the person believed it, but mostly it was because he staged them, as most faith healings we have come to learn are. People coughed up cancer after he quote-unquote healed them, which was later found to be bloody chicken gizzards. What one of his followers was so loyal that they're like, I'm gonna put bloody raw chicken gizzards in my mouth and do this like song and dance with you? I'd be out there. But the most egregious, the most bizarre stunt I heard by survivors on the documentary Jonestown Terror in the Jungle was this.
One Sunday service, I was out in the parking lot talking to someone.
We're all out to church and we're having festivities. The kids are playing the basketball court. We got tables out for the meal in between church.
Bright, sunny, beautiful day. We were enjoying ourselves.
There's someone trying to assassinate Jim Jones.
Our leader's been gunned down.
People were screaming, "Father shot! Father shot!"
There's blood flowing from his chest.
Then they rushed everybody into the temple. We're scared because we don't know if someone else is out there shooting. Was it one shooter? Was it more than one shooter? The doors opened, and one of Jim's security was carrying the shirt with blood.
There's red stains on it. And there's two holes that you can put a finger through.
And Jim's behind him, but there's not a mark on him.
He's healed himself. It wasn't until later that I knew that that was fake.
Next week, we will cover his moving his cult to San Francisco. We will hear about survivors' stories and why they needed to flee for Guyana. In the final episode, episode 3 on Jonestown, we will cover that final stage of his cult and the mass killing that occurred in that remote village. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Until next week. Love you.